I'm Paul Moffat.
I'm Jan Moffat.
And this is Clockworks, a Legion podcast. We have a special episode of Clockworks for you this week. We have an interview with Denny Gordon. She is the director of episode 7 of Legion.
I was unfortunately not able to be here at this for this interview because I had to work, but I was excited to hear Paul, and we'll talk more after the interview's over about my thoughts on what she has to say. But for now, just enjoy hearing about episode 7 from Denny Gordon.
So, Denny Gordon, welcome here, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. We're so excited you guys like the show.
I've loved the show all the way through, and we're really excited to be talking about it in general and with you now.
Fantastic. You know, when we started the show, there was no certainty, of course, on how the audience would how the core fans and how the audience would spark to it. So
right.
Everyone's just been over the moon about the excitement, and I think we're doing 10 next season.
That's great.
So really good. Off we go.
I mean, I can say the first episode, one of the things that my wife and I, who unfortunately couldn't be here for the interview, and she's disappointed about that, but one of the things that we found with the very first episode was an episode of television where neither of us felt any desire to reach for our phones to look away at all. And that's, you know, kind of unusual.
Yes. It's so compelling, you might miss a detail.
And I have to say, episode 7, which you directed, is my favorite of the episodes in first season. I really love that episode.
Thank you. It was so much fun to do.
I wanted to start by asking, in general, do you watch TV shows that you make, and specifically Legion? Like, do you then watch the show?
You know, Legion was a new show, and there was nothing to watch. So all I had was Noah's script when I first met Noah. And they came to me, you know, many months before they started shooting the show. And but the script was so evocative. And, you know, you can imagine even in its written form that it was already so haunting and so compelling. And the need to know what was happening with David was so strong. But the imagery that Noah put in the script was it really spoke to me. So even not having seen a frame of footage because they were editing the pilot, I was able to do an image. I'm a commercial director, so I did an image board of my own and brought it in to share with Noah and John Cameron, the producer, and Lauren Schuler Donner, the other producer. And it was rather uncanny because we had some of the same images. And it was like Noah and I did a Vulcan mind melding. We thought, okay, we're thinking the same way. We're speaking the same language. But to answer your question, frequently, because I'm so busy and there's so much great content, I didn't have time to I normally don't have time. I was hired to direct an episode of Bloodline, and I had to hurry up and, you know, catch up on the entire season right. In the same way. So I love to study the episodes before I get on set and to really, you know, understand what we're attempting to accomplish.
I mean, and that's one of the questions, the related question you partially answered right there, but is about, you know, I know you often will direct an episode of an ongoing series. And I was curious about how that works as a director of a single episode, or two or three, or do you watch the whole series as preparation for the episode? How does it work to be the director of an episode coming into a show in general?
Well, I think, you know, I always love to make connection with the showrunner, with the writers, and just say, what are the episodes that for you were like really essential right. in the arc of the show that checked all the boxes for you, that was visually thrilling, that was emotionally compelling, you know, really understand what their favorite are, because sometimes it's, you know, you don't have time to watch 30 episodes, but you can catch up by getting inside the head of the writers that way.
In Legion in particular, like you just said, you had the script. Did you have the script? At what stage of completion was the script of the seventh episode when you saw it? Was it completely as it was? Was it still in the process? How does it work with Legion specifically, with the episode you directed?
Well, by the time I came on set for episode 7, they were filming episode 6, and okay. I was able to look at the dailies for all the previous episodes, which was very, very compelling. And also to hear from Noah about what he was liking. And part of the joy of this project and working with Noah Hawley, who's, you know, clearly a brilliant mind, was that he was encouraging the filmmakers to be bold.
Right.
And he was encouraging, you know, the filmmakers to really color outside the lines. And so when we got 7, you know, what you do is you meet with the director of photography, and they're two of them on a show like Legion, yep. the prepping DP and the shooting DP. So you have a chance to start talking about the imagery. So Dana Gonzalez, Emmy Award winning, fantastic director of photography, was mine. And Michael Wiley, the production designer, and Jonathan Ross, the visual effects supervisor. We put our heads together because Noah was busy writing 8 and creating, you know, season 2, the next season of Fargo, and, you know, his next novel and his next movie. And so we were, you know, they're all very good at getting inside Noah's head. I learned to get inside Noah's head with them. We were working to connect the dots. We were working to say, what do you think he means here? Well, let's try this. It's a kind of an odyssey that you go on, this journey with all the other creative partners, to sort of say, what is this moment? And of course, you're dealing with schizophrenia,
yeah.
but possibly. So you're dealing with, you know, what is real, and we're blurring the lines between what is real and, you know, what's imagined. And it's a pretty rich canvas for a filmmaker, but it's a very fun way to sort of take the viewers on a journey.
Yeah, absolutely. The journey of episode 7 was fantastic. The journey of the series has been fantastic.
Good.
Still on practical terms, just how much time does it take one for you as a director? What's your total time commitment to one episode of Legion?
Let's see. I went up to Vancouver while Michael Uppendahl, one of the executive producers, was directing, because I wanted to get the lay of the land. And
right.
a lot of the guys on the crew were friends of mine from other projects. And so the AD, Corey Faulkner, said, study the episodes. Just watch. He said, it's so layered and so complex. Watch as much as you can. Watch every daily that you can, so that when you land and you start directing, you have all of that in your head. And that turned out to be fantastic advice. So specifically the time, I mean, I did that on my own time, really see that, and then a lot of prep on my own before I landed in Vancouver. And then once in Vancouver, it was about 2.5, maybe 3 weeks of prep and about 8 days of shooting.
Okay.
So it seems short, but it's, you know, every minute is chock full of visualizing and storyboarding and right. dreaming, I mean, mostly dreaming.
And that's, I mean, one of the reasons I asked that question is exactly what you said. I would have imagined that you start working and thinking about it before you have officially started working, that is, being on set, right? As you said, you do a lot of thinking and preparing, and it's a little bit similar. In my day job, I'm an academic, and one of the things that I do writing academic work is hours and hours of what looks like staring at a blank computer screen doing nothing, and then I can sit down and write something. And
yes,
I suspect I was wondering, and I suspect there's a similar kind of, by the time you're on set, you already must have a very clear vision of what you're going to be doing when you're there. Is that right?
Hopefully. Hopefully. There was still, you know, and we'll get into it later when we talk about the silent movie thing, but, you know, there's always surprises on the journey, like, oh, that didn't work, or, oh, I know what we want to accomplish here, but we don't have the techno, you know, we don't have that tool today. So, you know, every day is some kind of new adventure in terms of what we dreamt up in tandem with what we, you know, what we can actually accomplish.
Right. So Legion in general is a very surreal and psychedelic show. And this episode 7 in particular, I mean, it's possibly the most surreal episode yet. Are you a fan of psychedelic art in general?
You know, I guess the best way to answer that is to say I'm a fan of visuals that take you on a journey, and I guess it's like dropping a tab of acid in some ways. I always approach it from a visual perspective. Right. And once I had the sets in my head, then you can start to trip off on invention, like that astral plane in Seven, that all white psych that we created, and letting the images blow out as we did. That was just an invention between myself, the DP, Dana, and Michael Wiley, the production designer. We wanted everything. We wanted that astral plane to just be a gigantic, blown out white space, as memories sometimes are.
Yeah, I love that scene, by the way, the visual of the white that seems infinite with just one little red box in the middle, and the sense of space created by that, by the, as you say, the blown out white visuals. The blown out white space that seems to go on forever, and it provides this real sense of both this being a safe space for them to be, but also it being a completely expansive infinite, and the little red box in the middle that seems tiny because of how huge the white space seems. That was right. Very visually appealing shot and scene.
Wonderful.
And I mean, when I talk about psychedelic, I mean, I hope that our listeners, and that in general, the psychedelic in terms of dropping acid, I don't think is as interesting as exactly what you were saying about psychedelic art. One of the things that's so appealing about Legion, and what's so appealing about psychedelic art for me as a viewer, is exactly what you say about visuals that are packed with meaning and significance, and they're not necessarily straightforward. They require some thought and some unpacking on the part of the viewer.
Yes.
Is that a kind of visual that you are drawn to?
Absolutely. And in terms of the script, sometimes it sprang from an emotional idea, like the white space is sort of terrifying in its infiniteness.
Yep.
And you feel extremely uneasy. But yes, there was this one little safe tube, and we thought of it was like those old school tubes, you know, like those old mail tubes,
right?
Or this silent little space where they could have this real conversation. So sometimes those images spring from what feels like what's emotionally right. We did a lot of imagery that, you know, didn't make it into the episode as well, because we were just exploring and, you know, going mad. We had one astral plane that we really loved, which was all white, but just a black mound of dirt, a dirt in the middle with this black tree, didn't end up making it into the episode, but always kind of inventing a universe that would sort of take the moment and turn it on its head and take it in a different way. Because in the same way that the audience doesn't know half the time whether it's real or not, sometimes those of us creating aren't so sure either.
Right.
So sometimes we're just satisfying our desire to do, like, oh, that's a really cool thing. I've always wanted to do that, and we're going to do it here today.
And one of the things I've read in an interview that Noah Hawley said about the series is, I don't need you to understand it, I just need you to experience it. Is that something that rings true for you also?
For all of us, absolutely. And it was true for the cast. It was true. You know, sometimes the actors would ask questions and we wouldn't have solid, crisp answers. You know, we needed to just say, just be in the moment, trust the moment. What's real today? What's real right now? And let that be our guide. But we were on that same experiential journey. Noah created this amazing playground, and we were all just privileged to play in that playground, even though we didn't always know where we were going or what the result was going to be.
So your episode is striking for, especially for having these three stylized sections that break from the style so far of Legion. I mean,
yes,
such as it is, it's already a show that is, as you say, pushing the stylistic boundaries all over the place. But the three sections in episode 7 specifically are the chalkboard animation sequence, the zombie-style chase sequence when the mental patients are chasing Amber Midthunder Carrie down the hallways, and it is just like a zombie movie, and the silent film sequence. So I have specific questions about each one of these, but before we get to them, can you talk at all about the idea behind shifting the visual language throughout the episode?
I think that Noah is probably one of the most visual writers I've ever worked with, and he wants us to just trip out on what is possible. You know, whether it's black and white or whether it's overexposed, you know, in a white world, whether we pull out the sound, he's just game to experience, to take you on a journey in so many different ways. And so it was probably the most fun thing I've ever done for that reason. And Noah wouldn't always say, this is what I see and this is what I want. It was up to us.
Right.
So those three sections, and there's a very interesting different story behind each of those three sections about how we arrived at it.
All right. Well, why don't we start then with the chalkboard animation? If there's an interesting story, how did you arrive at that chalkboard animation section?
That was always scripted. Noah always saw that as, David, we had to really understand the style of the animation, but it was us working very closely with an animation company here in Los Angeles called Floyd County. But as scripted, it's a series of revelations on David's part. And it's, of course, everyone watching the show has been waiting for all of these things to fit together.
Right.
So a classroom with a chalkboard and someone's kind of guiding you through it. It was sort of like we were a little inspired by A Beautiful Mind.
Yep.
We were inspired by the idea of, a genius calculus, being kind of all made into one whole. Noah wrote that scene exactly as you ended up seeing it. But what had to be determined were so many details. We had a 9-panel blackboard. What animation was going to go where? Right. And I very much wanted it to build. It was a long scene. It's like a 6-minute scene, probably one of the longest in the series. And what was going to be on each of those 9 panels at all times? And how does it build? And I wanted a library step that as things start to come together, David excitedly runs up. And this makes sense. Dan Stevens had to launch the animations because that first baby that he drew had to be in the style of where we were going. So there was just tremendous discussion.
And did Dan draw that first baby himself?
Dan drew the first baby and then the style, then the animators took off. And
right.
We wanted it to be just continually alive as his brain is firing on all cylinders. As he's piecing everything together. So we were thrilled with the final result. But at the, we didn't have any of the real animations at the time that I was filming it. So it was, it was very challenging. We were doing motion control, obviously, to go from David's rational British mind to David at the blackboard and his revelations and, how to make that interesting for 6 minutes and all the different angles that would be. And I kept David rational mind, Brit, jumping all around this classroom.
Yeah.
To show that he was omnipresent, that he was never going anywhere. He was always going to be there speaking to the other David.
I noticed the way that as you said, it builds through the scene, that it starts with just one panel of the blackboard and then it moves to 2 and 3 and it expands. And by the end, it's a single animation taking up all the 9 panels of the blackboard. And that, I think, was very effective for visualizing this idea of expanding his understanding and expanding his sense of what is happening, as well as expanding the audience's sense of what's happening.
Yes. And so many people contributed to the success of that scene, but I drew it on storyboards initially with an artist in Vancouver. And then we started going back and forth between Noah and the animation company, Floyd County, and between the team of us. It was my idea to let that final image be gigantic and large. And I'm so glad that they embraced that because it just felt right. Image was just, overtaking him.
Absolutely. Frankly, in any other episode, I think that animation sequence would be the standout moment of the episode.
Right.
In this episode, the only possible thing that casts any shadow on that episode is how the silent film section overshadows it. That is a phenomenal and fantastic sequence. And can you tell me a bit about that silent film section.
Well, this is an interesting story. It was not scripted as a silent movie scene. And Noah had only said two words to me about what he wanted to be going on in that Clockworks hallway, and those two words were horror film. So, you know, that's all you have to say to a team like ours, and, you know, we're off. But, and then you have an actress like Aubrey Plaza playing Lenny, and, you know, naturally it's going to go in a sort of a Beetlejuice direction. So we had all these elements, and it was not working, frankly, when we got into post. It was between what was happening in that hallway, between David trying to get out of his coffin and you know, burst through and save his team frozen in time in his bedroom. I mean, there was a lot going on, and it was blurring a sort of a more straightforward version of the hallway, which we had shot. I mean, believe me, it was not straightforward. It was straightforward Legion style, but that it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a silent movie. It wasn't Arch. It wasn't its own sort of different stylistic discrete moment. And it was sort of blurring the episode. It was not as crisp. It was not as powerful as we knew we needed it to be, because it's so, everything's escalating, everything's building. So it was Noah's idea. The episode had been cut together for, you know, several weeks, but that one section was still gnawing at him. And, you know, to his enormous credit and the team's credit, we were able to go back and take that material and add those cards. And it was such a great idea, because by pulling out the sound, it was so much more terrifying. By pulling out the sound, because we had all the sound of the screaming and the, you know, the zombies and everything that Lenny was saying, and it just put it on its own astral plane, as it were. But this is part of the, it's a discovery. It wasn't happening. It wasn't designed to be that way initially.
So it was, hold on, it was shot with all the sound. You didn't reshoot it as a silent film. You re-edited it into a silent film. Is that right?
Exactly.
Wow. That's.
It was shot as a normal scene. It was shot, you know, with all the actors, Rachel, Amber, Mackenzie, everybody speaking dialogue.
And then
it was created entirely in post.
Wow. That's maybe even more amazing, because it ends up looking fantastic. And the visuals, like the black and white and the way that the camera angles are reminiscent of German expressionist film. I mean, I'm not a film scholar by any means, but I have seen The Cabinet of Dr. Cagliari and The Man Who Laughs, and it resembles those silent film. Like it seems like a reference to those silent films already. It's amazing to me that that was then an additional element added to it.
Well, I think the film language that that I was speaking in that hallway, was. You probably could call it German expressionism. So, you know, it was low angles, and it was, which felt really right, because Lenny is so powerful. So it was shot that way for story and for emotional purposes.
Right.
And it was, but, you know, they're speaking real lines. I mean, those moments were all rendered as a, you know, actual series of moments. So, to Noah's incredible, with his mind, he just visually, and I know how, he just like, let's try this. Let's try this. What happens if? And the first time he popped it on us, we were all like, what? Wow. But that's part of the joy of the creative process, you know? So now you know our secret.
Wow. I mean, it paid off enormously. It is a fantastic sequence of...
Thrilled. We were all so thrilled with the way it turned out.
Right. You talked, part of me wants to just keep talking about the silent film section, but I don't know what else I have to specifically say, but you talked a second ago about horror was the one note that you went into that sequence with. So that's the other element of this episode that's stylistically distinct from the kind of set style of Legion, is the real horror film feel of, I mean, there have been horror film elements in throughout Legion, but specifically the zombie film elements of the chasing Ember Midthunder down the hallway, and then the reference to they live with the glasses that they put on and see the real reality. Why the horror movie Touchstone? What's the rationale behind that? I think I can imagine, but can you talk a bit about that?
Well, I think from the story perspective, I think there's some sort of the nightmares that we all have deep in our limbic brain, the terrors that are always lurking there. You know, we wanted to manifest that. You know, these sort of the worst imaginings are coming for David and everyone are coming to be true, and it's all coalescing. And so, zombies just felt like zombies and they live just felt right. It just felt in terms of what Sid is able to do with the glasses and able to fight her way through, because as with everything else in this series, people are fighting the rational and the irrational sides of their brain and what's real and what's not real. So they live and those zombies, I mean, I was influenced by 28 Days Later.
Right.
And, you know, to take the Clockwork's patients and turn them into zombies was something that we were all very excited about. It just felt right. You know, I remember there was this story that Walter Murch, Steven Spielberg's editor, the first time that those two great talents came together, and Spielberg said, "Why did you do it that way, Walter?" And Walter said, "Well, it just felt right." And that was the case in so many instances for this episode.
Right. Is that also the case? I mean, is the, when Sid puts on the glasses, or any of them put on the glasses, and the, we see through her point of view and everything turns black and white from color. There's such use, I mean, the use of color throughout the series, but the use of color in this episode is very striking. And we already talked about the white with the red pillar. That's an example. The way that the Clockwork's tends to be really red filtered. And then they put on the glasses and it all goes black and white. Why the black and white?
Well, I think we wanted to be very clear with the audience about what was real and what wasn't, and you know, real and what wasn't in, you know, in the Legion world is a you know, a thesis topic for someone
right
at some university, perhaps yours somewhere. But it just felt, again, it just felt right that there's the color and then the black and white, and the black and white. Noah had always written that when the glasses came, you know, the up and down, that there would be black and white and then there would be color. We shot everything in color, but we were very clear in our minds about what moments would be black and white.
Right.
And I think it's just such an evocative way to cue the audience, different world, different plane.
Because black and white, I mean, at the same time, what you said about real and unreal in Legion being up for grabs, being unclear. Black and white to signify what's real is such a complicated symbolically, because on one hand, there's a visual language that says this is different from what you've seen before. This is something, and because it's black and white, there's less, I mean, to be really literalist about it, there's less nuance. It's the real thing in black and white. But on the other hand, of course, the way that we experience the world is in color. So black and white is always more artificial than color, because we don't experience our real worlds in color, right?
Right, right. The opposite would have been maybe an obvious way to go. So this being Legion, we had to flip it one more time.
Right. So in addition to the horror movie elements that made this probably the scariest episode of Legion, there's also quite a bit of comedy in this episode, making it probably the funniest episode of Legion at the same time. Can you talk a bit about Jemaine Clement and Bill Irwin and their scene in the Ice Cube? I mean, they're two talented comic actors. Bill Irwin has been great throughout Legion dramatically, but he's been the source of a lot of the comedy up till now. Can you talk a bit about Jemaine Clement and Bill Irwin together in that Ice Cube?
Well, you can imagine it was like, I felt so privileged to be in that Ice Cube with them. I'm such fans of both of them. And we really wanted that scene to And Noah, very much, when we toned the episode, he said, you know, like, unearth it for the comedy, every molecule of comedy that you can get. And my background is improv comedy, and Lewis Black used to be my improv partner, and we didn't really talk that much about it. They're such instinctive comics.
Right.
You know, for me to say to Jermaine, I think, you know, how about more confusion there? Because Jermaine's whole, I mean, Oliver is not remembering everything. Oliver is sort of crystallized in the 60s. He's got a record player and a turntable, and he can't remember if his wife is Asian or not. He's searching for words that he can't find. And he says it was all a little bit, I don't know, dishes. Yeah. You know, he's just so, you know, Jermaine just embraced that so completely. And so there are revelations on both sides. I mean, Bill, that's where Bill figures out about the Shadow King. Of course, the Shadow King, the dog. So, you know, we had variations of performance, but we were all really enjoying the subtle comedy, and we wanted to, you know, I think that's what's so fun about a show like this, is that it does turn on a dime from being terrifying to, you know, remarkably funny, because, well, it's like Beckett, you know, Bill Irwin is the great Beckett interpreter, and I'm a Beckett fan and a Beckett scholar, and we would, you know, nothing is funnier than unhappiness was what Beckett always said, and we embrace that completely.
And there's is it significant? I said a second ago, the scariest episode and the funniest episode. Is it significant that those two things happen at the same time in the same episode? I would think that both horror and comedy are about the audience's emotional vulnerability. So the more scared they are, the more funny they're going to find things. And the exactly. more funny they find things, the more scared they're going to be, because both of those are means of decreasing the audience's emotional resistance to the episode.
Exactly, exactly. And isn't it like life? It's like you can look at this through, what's the prism you look at this through? Is that, you know, can you be bemused by this moment, or are you running screaming from the room? You know, it's just like life.
And the other scene, there's comedy throughout the episode, but the other big comic scene or sequences are the scenes with Dan Stevens acting opposite himself. Yeah. Was there a challenge to create comic timing between an actor and himself? Like, when there isn't, you said Jermaine Clement and Bill Irwin could act off each other. Dan couldn't have done that because there wasn't another person to act off of. So was it a challenge to create that comic timing?
Through technology, he could. I discussed it at length with Dan about how he wanted to attack it, because it was a tremendous challenge for him. And we used it in the chalkboard sequence, as well as the two selves trapped in the coffin. Yep. Where we landed... Well, first we decided, Dan and I just, you know, came to it together, and then we went back to Noah. Noah loved it and completely agreed. But we definitely agreed that the rational side of David's mind would be British.
Right.
As I think maybe perhaps the rational side of all of our brains are British, that collected, you know, calm, erudite, you know, very linguistically brilliant selves. So what we decided to do, we discussed it at length, but I said to Dan, wouldn't you like to act opposite your other character, so that you're timing and you can really interact and you can just, so we recorded all of British David, okay. all of rational David, and had that recorded. And then we recorded all of regular David, normal David, coming to grips with all this new information. And our sound team, our brilliant sound team, and especially our playback artist, Valerie, had found a tiny, tiny, tiny little earwig that we were able to put in Dan's ear. And so Dan was, you know, whoever he was playing, he could completely be in that head,
right.
and be acting with the actor playing the other side of him. It was tremendously effective. And it took a while for us to land at that moment and to trust that moment. But now looking back, I can't think of any other way we could have accomplished that.
I mean, you say the technology allows it, but I mean, I have seen, and I imagine you probably have seen, actors acting opposite themselves in more and less effectively. And
that sometimes it can be terrible.
Yeah, it can be. And I don't think I would just say, I'm sure the technology makes it much easier, but the technology can't accomplish it by itself, right? It requires both.
Listen, we had the technology, but without a brilliant actor like Dan Stevens, it would have been extremely treacherous territory. Right. But because Dan is Dan and such a fully committed actor and so tremendously focused, that he was able to completely inhabit those two different characters, and not even for a second step outside of himself and realize that that voice was coming in through his ear.
Right.
So I think, the technology exists, but, an actor of Dan Stevens' caliber is one in a trillion. So,
I mean, the moment when he speaks in when American David speaks in a British accent stands out as particularly funny and effective.
Pure Dan, he goes, he's like, okay, hello, I'm home, honey, show me some sugar. And then the British Dan goes, wait, so your father's British? Which, of course, we love, because that was like an inside reference. That was improv, and it was also a fun reference to Patrick Stewart. So, this is part of what's fun. You go down the rabbit hole, and it's just endless what you can discover and find.
On the topic of the practical logistics, the Dan Stevens acting opposite Dan Stevens is one major one. There's other moments in this episode where I'm sure our listeners are curious about the practical logistics of how it was done. I think especially of the scene in David's bedroom and all the actors acting around frozen versions of themselves. How did you go about filming that?
Let me first say that there was so much, it was extremely hard. And I had the pleasure on my episode of doing some high angles of Jermaine conducting in that scene. And it was great because we had to break the set and nobody was happier that set was getting torn apart. It was all so challenging, a tiny little room, 8 actors, sometimes 9, 10 actors in that space. We had very, very good doubles of each of the actors. But sometimes we had to ask our players to just be completely frozen.
Right.
We found that the motion control, as difficult and time consuming as it was the more effective way to approach that. There was so much work in that bedroom, and some of the other directors chose to just have the actors freeze. But it does have a different quality. They are kind of living and breathing. The motion control. Dana and I much preferred that aspect of it. So having them interact with their selves was very challenging. We had to be very careful. It had to be very specific. But that's the beauty of motion control. It's a precision instrument, and it repeats exactly. I'm not sure if that was exactly your question.
No, that's a great.
Motion control was primarily what we're doing in that space.
That's basically what I was wondering, because when you watch that scene, someone who knows nothing about making film, only about watching, that I can imagine a number of ways of approaching it that seem a whole range of difficulty and plausibility. So, having an actor just stand still, or having a CGI representation of them that they act around, and it's just interesting to know how you go about it.
It was intricate. And listen, sometimes we were able to get away with the frozen. The actor playing Rudy was especially great being frozen. And so we took advantage of that. Sometimes they froze in these very difficult positions. I think when they chose the frozen moment, I think, which was in episode 5, which I inherited the frozen moment. And we were like, oh, my God, why did you freeze that way? You're going to have to hold that position for hours and hours. So it was surgical precision, very careful shot composition, so that sometimes the actors could take a break, and we would single Jermaine out, or we'd single out Gene and Bill, and that would give all the frozen players a chance to massage their necks.
Right. Now, I noticed a lot of those special effects scenes in the bedroom, and then also we already talked about the chalkboard scene. I noticed a lot of unbroken shots moving from one thing to something else that couldn't possibly be actually there at the same time.
Right, those were all motion control shots.
Right.
But we very much are fans. We did a fair number of those practically in camera as well. And I did have a David double in the chalkboard sequence, I could have him soft focus in the background.
Right.
Motion control is difficult and expensive, and very often on this show, we would look at something and say, well, there's the, extremely expensive feature film blue chip version of how we would do this. And then there's the, how can we be clever and get some of this in camera? And that was part of the fun. Some of this stuff was done incredibly simply. And, you'd have to really study the show to sort of understand, there's that sheet moment.
Right.
But, as filmmakers, that was extremely fun. That was a fun part of the challenge. Like, okay, how do we get through this obstacle?
And speaking of the feature film way of approaching it, there's the moment of Mackenzie Gray Walter crumpling up, and then you do it twice. Like that.
Yes.
That seems to me, watching it, knowing nothing about anything, like an expensive special effect, especially to do twice. How is that shot conceived, and how is it implemented?
Well, of course, it was a composite. We put Mackenzie against a green screen and had him perform the moment. As I first envisioned it, it was going to go even further, that she was going to crush him like a can, right, and then she was going to do that little flick. And that he would have been crushed down to just an eyeball. We all really love, John Ross, our VFX supervisor, and I were big fans of that. But I think it was just a bridge too far, potentially in terms of cost, but also in terms of, the horrific aspect, right, of. So, we just crushed him down to like a little doll size, and then, and then Lenny was able to just go bing. But it was simpler than you thought. It was Mackenzie acting against a green screen, and then, John rendering it and doing a bunch of different, layers and layers and layers, so that he's literally compressing, all done in composite.
I think we're coming near the end of the time that you have agreed to talk to us. My last question for you is just, where can our listeners look forward to seeing your work next? You mentioned, before I even let you answer that, I interrupt you to my own question to say, you said something about, we're doing 10 episodes next season. Does that imply that you're going to be back on Legion next season?
There's no guarantee, but they're just starting to break it down in terms of episodes. So I don't, they haven't assembled their team yet.
Okay.
I'd love to go back, of course, and I very much hope I'll be invited back. I think, directors, we frequently say the we, because you get incredibly close with teams, that the creative teams that you work with. You really get deep in the trenches. So you end up walking away from these adventures, very close to everyone you work with. So, of course, we all look forward to gathering again and hope it comes to pass. To answer your first question, I'm leaving Wednesday for Santa Fe, New Mexico, to direct a miniseries called Waco, which is, yes, that Waco. We're shooting in Santa Fe. I don't think they let us back into Texas to do this, but it's a very exciting cast. Michael Shannon playing the FBI negotiator, and Taylor Kitsch playing David Koresh. We have John Leguizamo. We have Andrea Riceboro, both of whom were in my Bloodline. We have a really phenomenal cast. So we're very excited about that, and that is for Spike. And so that's what's next.
When can we expect to see that?
I think that will probably be coming out more in the fall. Look for that on Spike in the fall. And then after that, I'm doing Billy Bob Thornton's show Goliath on Amazon, which if you haven't checked it out, I encourage you to do so. It's marvelous writing, and Billy Bob is luminous in that role.
All right, I will. Well, thank you so very much for agreeing to talk to us. This has been a delightful conversation. I really appreciate it.
We appreciate you guys watching. I hope you enjoy season two.
I'm sure we will. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks so much. Keep in touch.
Okay. Bye.
Bye bye.
And that was our interview with Denny Gordon. I had an awful lot of fun talking to her. You've had a chance now to listen to the interview, Jan. What do you think about our conversation?
I'm still really disappointed that I couldn't have been there, but I love how she provides so many insights into the show and into especially the silent movie part. I think that was like the biggest revelation in this interview, to discover about how it wasn't intended to be a silent movie.
Yeah.
Like, that just blows my mind. And obviously it blew your mind. Like, you couldn't get over it right in the interview itself.
No.
And
we had talked a very little bit Denny Gordon, and I have to always call her by her entire name. I don't know, like, Denny, we're friends now.
Yeah,
sure. Denny and I had talked a little bit about the interview and preparing the kind of questions, but she did not give me any hint beforehand about that. She knew I was going to ask about the silent film section, but she didn't tell me anything beforehand about, so that was, like, a bombshell to me.
And it's kind of cool to have, like, we watch the show with all these bombshells that get dropped, like King isn't a real dog or whatever, and then we listen to it, we have an interview where we get even more bombshells dropped, and this has been a lot of fun. I love it. We have some more interviews coming up. We have two more people that we're interviewing from the behind the scenes of the show. The next one will be next week. We'll be interviewing Jeff Russo, who does the score of Legion and the beautiful music, and he has really insightful things to say, and it'll be really good. I was there for the interview with Jeff Russo, but I honestly didn't say very much because I was super nervous, and Paul knows way more about music than I do, so I was there but barely there. And then the third interview we do will reveal later on who that's going to be, and I definitely am now comfortable talking to people from Hollywood.
So yeah, all three exciting things coming ahead in Clockworks. Check out our interview with Jeff Russo next week. Thank you very much for joining us this time, and we'll see you then. I've been Paul Moffat.
I've been Jan Moffat. If you want to talk to us more about this interview or have some questions that were answered in this for you that you thought were cool, give us a shout on Twitter at ClockworksCast or an email, clockworkscast@gmail.com. As usual, you can support us by rating and reviewing us on iTunes and directly on patreon.com/clockworkscast. Thank you for listening.
Goodbye.